Hi, everybody. My name is David Anderson, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
Welcome to birthday night / speaker night at the Meridian Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a safe one. We are glad you are all here, especially the newcomers. We ask that all cell phones be turned off at this time and all texting stop. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, keeping with our singleness of purpose in our third tradition, which states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. We ask that all who participate confine their discussion to their problems with alcohol, the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. It does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any controversy. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Those who care to help me open this meeting with a moment of silent prayer or meditation, and we'll follow that with a sermon and prayer out loud. Serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Is there anyone here at this meeting for the first time or any visitors who would like to introduce themselves?
I'm Sam, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Sam.
Glad you're here, Sam. The Meridian Group believes sponsorship is an essential part of recovery. If there is anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you do not have a sponsor, please look around the room and visit with one of these people after the meeting. I've asked Maureen to read that.
Yeah. I'm Maureen, alcoholic.
Right. When we get to the steps, we will go around the room and 12 different people will each read a step.
Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunate. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable.
Number two. David. David believed that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Part of your day. Make decisions, turn our will and our lives over the care of God to be understood.
4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our life.
6. One probably ready to have God remove these defects in character.
7. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings.
8. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all.
9. We recommend that people, wherever possible, accept community service and
take personal inventory and when we're around company.
Start comparing meditation to improve our conscious contact with ours. Bring home some spiritual corruption and start to figure that out.
Well, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these tests, to speak out experience as a way out to follow the direction of the moral order.
Many of us exclaim, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sovereign.
All right. Thank you. I've got Sonia to read the quote.
Sonia,
that's
right.
Sonia, that's
right. Sure. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery begins with my AA. For our first purpose, there is one ultimate authority, a loving God who may express himself in our group consciousness. Our leaders are but trusting servants, we do not know them. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, accepting others' ambition of the groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has one primary purpose, carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group will have recourse, finance, or many AA names, any related facility or outside enterprise. Less problems with money, property, and prestige to bring us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group must be fully self-supporting and finding outside locations. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such are never be worthless, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those we serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name might never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and sales. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our decisions, and every Monday at the place principles of work.
Thank you, Simon. Tammy's going to read.
Hi, I'm Tammy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
we are painstaking about the state of our development. We will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret nor wish to shut the door. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. Feeling of usefulness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurities will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Thank you to all our readers. Our seventh tradition reminds us we're self-supporting through our own contributions. If you have a paper to be signed, you can throw it in that basket. We'll take care of it. On Wednesday night, we also pass the little green can, which helps buy literature for the jail meetings and the prisons and that kind of stuff. The green can is for, the orange can is for that.
Yes, the orange can.
The green can helps offset expenses that some of the ladies take meetings to the prisons in Gatesville. Announcements at Root Conscience next Wednesday at 7. Meet at Bunkhouse and pick out and talk for an hour and then come up here and fuss and fight and then have a meet today. What else we got? Campfire meeting is the second Saturday of the month next month in Walnut Springs, which month on what day it is. Must be the 8th. Anybody else have any AA related in that?
I'm Lorraine, an alcoholic.
Hey, Lorraine.
We had a little committee meeting to get one for our group anniversary, but there were two of us there. A couple people we knew had excused absences, but if we don't get more people coming to our meetings, we'll have to decide that as a group conscience, whether we even want to have an anniversary. So, that's the only agenda for the next one.
Thank you, Lorraine. All right, anybody else? It's birthday night. We've got two birthdays that we know of on the board. Is there anybody else from our group that's celebrating? Not anybody that's celebrating a July birthday that likes to be recognized?
Not much.
We've already got three birthdays.
You have years.
Yeah.
Deb L. has 2 years on the 25th. She's not here tonight. Let's give her a hand, isn't it? That leaves one more. I was asked to introduce her. It's kind of a frightening honor. I don't think I've ever had to introduce anybody that I've been that close to before. Thank you, Drew. I guess all I can say is I'm really proud of my wife, Pam. I know it's been a really long road. And a tough one. Yeah. Especially the last 6 months or so, I've seen her work this deal harder than I've ever seen. She's going through the steps, and I can see the difference. I told her the other night we'd go to a meeting together, and if her one or two particular people weren't available to talk, she just went as far away as she could. And I've watched her the last few months, and she seeks people out. And that's a neat deal, because the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting are just as big a deal as the meeting for the meeting. We don't have a 1 year chip, but she got her chip at the lake the other night. And anyhow, and celebrating 1 year, and she gets to talk. She's got to stand up and hug me because she's so.
Right.
Not the best sex on women.
No, we've been. I passed on a little virus to him. I don't want him to pass it back to me, so. Hopefully it'll come out. I'm Tammy, and I'm an alcoholic.
It's
Friday day, July the 3rd, 2008. About a year ago, I was, I don't know what I was doing, just looking through some stuff, and I found this whole bag hooked up. Some marijuana I didn't even know I had, and, oh! You know, and, I can't smoke this, so I'm not getting rid of it. Okay, well, you know, I stashed it away, and I sat on it for, I don't know, 2 months, maybe not even that long, I don't know, and, you know, sucked out the contents of cigarettes, and refilled it with my own brand, and that was that. So it ate away at me, and ate away at me, so I told my sponsor, and and over the telephone, I dumped the stuff down the plate. She says, okay, then you dumped that. If David wasn't home in the house, I don't know if he knew what was going on. I don't know. He knew I'd been acting weird. He did tell me that. But anyway, that was last year. That's done. That's over. This is this year. Some things happened, which were pretty good. And I've got a new sponsor. I love her. She's plain, down to earth, and I just love her. And I don't know, God's working in my life today more than I have seen in a long time in my life, whether it's me letting Him or in time of surrender, and not to let him, but he is there, and the things that have occurred in my life, I'd say in the last 6 months, are because of him, and the love of people in this rooms all around, just like y'all in this room. And I have my little chip. I have pockets I have in my bra. I'm with the tape.
A lot of times we pass our birthday chips around for people to pray over, but I don't think we're going to. That's a whole other program. All right, anybody else got a birthday before we shift into high gear? All right.
No, but I have announced. The weekend after Labor Day weekend, a bunch of us from the West Group and the Whitney Group and this group too, I guess, is going to have a party at the State Park by the swimming area.
Whitney?
No, at Whitney State Park.
Oh, all weekend.
Yeah, Friday, Saturday, what is that, 11?
I think it's at 10, 11, and 12. We're going to have folks.
Yeah. About six weeks away.
Awesome.
Yeah, there are a lot of people bringing boats and all kinds of stuff.
I'm just going to ride the smoke boat.
Bring your camp.
Cool. Thanks. All right. We'll kick it into speaker night now. That's one of the cool things about chairing speaker meeting night is you get to introduce the person you invite and you get to invite somebody you want to hear. Drew is somebody that I've watched since I met him in jail, at the jail meeting, and we had a few issues in jail, but we kind of got past those, and I've watched through the last couple of years, and, you know, there's a lot of people that just come in and they just kind of hang around the fringes, and they make meetings here and there, and they don't really do anything else, and then there's the people that you see the light come on. And I saw the light come on early on, and he's really put his heart and soul into this deal the last 2 years. And I don't get to see him a lot, but we've had some good talks man to man and other times. I just wanted to hear his story. He's writing a book, and I've had the privilege of being able to read one of the first drafts, and I was really impressed. Want to know more, especially about his sobriety, but just about through. So, Drew, the floor is yours. It's all yours.
Thanks, Dave. I'm Drew Tindall. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Drew.
And, yeah, we did have some tough times in the jail cell, didn't we? I remember the first time we met, it was kind of interesting. He was all this about God, and I was all about get God out of my face. And I really just, if they didn't write the chapter for the agnostics in this book, I probably wouldn't be in here today. That's the honest truth. That chapter changed my view on exactly what David was trying to explain to me. So, you know, I was still in my drunk mind, and I didn't want to hear anything about God at all. God let me down my whole life. That's the way I thought it. Believe it or not, my sick mind was pretty sick. As far as what it was like before I met David in that jail cell, my worst fear in life was being abandoned and being alone. And you can see a pattern of my life to where I was the cause of that all throughout my life. You know, when I was real young, my parents got married and divorced, and I was kicked back and forth to each family. When one got tired of me, I got sent to the other one. And that feeling of abandonment was there since early on in my life.
I do remember the first time I drank. I was 7 years old, and my parents were going through another divorce, and they sent me to stay with my aunt for a couple of weeks. And my aunt is an alcoholic, but luckily she's got 10 years in this program now, so this program works. But anyways, when we were at her house, it was a 4th of July, and she had malt duck. I don't know if y'all ever had malt duck. But to me, a 7-year-old kid, that malt duck tasted like Kool-Aid. And while I was there, I got drunk. And I was 7 years old running around the pool with all these people at this 4th of July party, and I was popping off firecrackers, and I felt like the center of attention. I loved what alcohol did to me. I mean, I really did. The alcohol just... it made me feel like I belonged. Believe it or not. I don't know if any of y'all felt the same feeling, but for me, that's what it did for me when I first tried it. After my parents got divorced, though, I was sent to live with my dad and my stepmother in Hereford, Texas. And they were a real strict, Christian-oriented family. To where, you know, if I did anything wrong, I was going to hell. I mean, that's the way they believed, and that's what I was taught that whole time when I lived with them for 4 years. And even with them, my stepmother had two sons and a daughter, and I'm the only one that doesn't have a mother and father there. I got a father, but my father was always at work. So I know she didn't mean to do it, but she did it. She favored those other three kids, so therefore the abandonment issue was still there. I mean, I still felt lonely. So I was still searching for someone to love me, someone to be my friend, I guess. I don't know how it looks, but for me, that's how it looked at that time. When I was 14 years old, my dad and stepmother decided that it was time for me to move back in with my mom. They decided that the way my dad put it was, Dallas, Texas is where the pretty people live, and that's where you belong. And that's how it was said to me. I was 14 years old. I had no clue of what they were talking about. But all of a sudden, I moved in with my mom and my stepdad and my older brother, Ty. And at that point was where the alcoholism hit full force, because my mother's an alcoholic, and you know she's got 16 years in this program now, so it's working for her too. But living with her and my stepdad, they were pretty well off, and they had a really nice stock bar. And I was 14. I invited all my friends over, and my mother let us drink. So it was kind of common knowledge that we could drink as long as we stayed in the house. So we stole their liquor left and right. We drank all the time. I mean, that was part of my life. I mean, I had to have alcohol, even at 14 years of age. By the time I turned 15, I had dropped out of school. I abandoned all my friends, so there I go, me being the abandoner rather than me feeling abandoned, but I felt abandoned too, even though it's my fault. But I got kicked out of school. My parents sent me to a military academy in Culver, Indiana, and me being the smart little alcoholic kid that I was, I started playing poker to win money to get a trip back to Dallas. And I was there for 2 weeks before I won enough money on Greyhound to drive back to Dallas. And when I got back to Dallas, my parents found out that I went AWOL from this military academy. And everything I owned, which was about three suitcases, was on the front porch. And I was kicked out. I had no home to live. I was 15 years old. So, I wasn't a very smart alcoholic. But after getting kicked out of school, I got a job. I lied about my age and got a job. I lost it because of alcoholism. I had enough money for my beer and my marijuana, but I didn't have enough money for my rent or food. So I worked at a grocery store and I started stealing food off the shelves. And sweatpants, that was the thing that worked for me. I had big sweatpants because I was skinny, so I didn't have enough money to eat. So I'd steal, and then one day they said they wanted to talk to me in their office. And I went into the office, and they said, we did an inventory on the meat department, and that's where I worked. And they said, we're missing a lot of meat. I was eating steak and shrimp every night, too.
I said, well, I don't know what to tell you. And they said, well, yeah, you do. And they showed me the video of me stealing the meat. And luckily, God was with me then, too. I lost my job, but they didn't press charges. And they could have easily pressed charges on me. So that was one deal of losing a job because of this disease. Right after that, I started dabbling in the harder drugs like crystal meth and cocaine and this pill that they called ecstasy that I just fell in love with. And one day, I was with a friend of mine, and we were driving down the road, and we had just worked on his car, all skitzed out on whatever it was we were on, and he rolled his car, and he flew out of the car, and the car ran over him and killed him, and I was unhurt. And that's when my mind just clicked. It was one of those aha moments. I can't do drugs anymore. So I never touched drugs again after that moment, but alcohol was legal. So in my alcoholic mind, drugs are out of my life, but the alcohol's not. I was 16 at that time. And David, he was a real good friend of mine, and I miss him to this day. There's nothing I could do to change it. But you know, that's one of those lessons in life that you learn. And why I didn't stop drinking at that point in my life, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I lost a couple more jobs because of it. I'd worked for this company for 5 years, and I was doing really good. And I mean, I was drinking, but I was handling it to a certain level to where it wasn't really hurting my performance in my eyes, but I know it was. I had a route to where I went to different places around Denton, Texas, and one morning I was real hungover, and I got in my van, and I was driving, and I don't know what happened. I fell asleep at the wheel or something, and I hit a little Toyota truck on Highway 380 out of Denton and knocked him into an oncoming semi. And luckily, no one was killed, but 2 years later, I was in a 7-Eleven, and I was buying a 12-pack of beer and a pack of cigarettes, and I walked up to the clerk, and the clerk was in leg braces. He said, "Are you Drew Tindall?" I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Well, I'm the guy you hit. I was in that Toyota truck, and I'm crippled for life." And I looked at him, and I dropped the 6-pack, or the 12-pack, I dropped the cigarettes, and I ran out of support. I didn't know what to say to him. It was a real emotional part of my life, and to this day, I haven't made amends to that man because I don't know who he is. I don't know his name. I don't know anything about him. But in my heart, I wish I could reach out and touch out to him and tell him how sorry I was and if there's anything I could do to make it better. That was a tough, tough time of my life, and I lost the job because of it. And at that time, I just got married to my first wife, and now we'll start talking about my victims and alcoholism. It's not very good. I met Amber at a party, and I swore I wasn't going to drink because I was trying to make a good impression. She drank and drank and drank. She asked me if I could take her home. I gave her a ride home, and she said she was getting sick, so I pulled over and walked out to the other side of the car, and she opened the door, and she threw up all over my shoes. Right then, that was love at first sight. I love this woman. She's mine. Well, we got married about 6-8 months after that, and for 18 months, I lost my job. I kept having other jobs. I finally found a job in the bartending business to where I could drink and work, and kind of worked out for me, but didn't work out for her. My sick mind, because I was behind the bar and she was on the other side of the bar with the patrons, my sick mind thought she was cheating on me. So to get back at her, I don't even know if she was cheating on me at all, but to get back at her, I found somebody that would go out with me, and I cheated on my wife. And right after that, we broke up. Before the ink dried on those divorce papers, I found my second victim. It's my second wife, Lindsay, and I really love her. She's a really good person. She's really good at heart. She's very creative, and it's weird how these alcoholics can bring in these good people and just mess up their lives. And that's what I did. That's what I was good at. And anyways, we were married 18 months. That seems to be my record at this point. I can, you know, 18 months long, and that's about it. And that's when it ends. One day I came home from work, slobbering drunk, and I walked in the house, and she had called my work earlier and asked me to come home sober, and I didn't. I went and got drunk, and I came home. And I looked on the mantle, and there was a bunch of Al-Anon and alcoholic material on the top of the mantle. I kind of looked at her funny and said, "Who's the alcoholic?" Duh. Is it my mom? Is it my aunt? Is it my brother? Is it my sister-in-law? Who's the alcoholic? Who did you get all this stuff for? And she looked at me and she said, "We need help." And I looked at her, I said, "I don't need any help." And we started arguing. And first time in my life, I knocked her down. And I told myself my whole life I'd never abuse a woman, but I just mentally abused her and physically abused her. And I mean, I went outside, I picked her up after I knocked her down, I picked her up, put her in the bed, and I went outside and cried for 2 or 3 hours. I didn't know how to deal with this. I knew I was sick, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know how to deal with this. And within a month, she was gone. And during that time in my life, I was pretty messed up. I was drinking Crown Royal like as quick as I could. I took my Jeep out and met this girl, another victim in my life. And I had a Jeep that I had worked on, and it was all, you know, four-wheel drive, big wheels. And I asked this girl that I didn't even know to go riding with me to go four-wheel, and I was drunker than a skunk. And I rolled my Jeep, and I broke my arm, broke my right leg, my back. She had abdominal injuries. But God was with me then, too. We both survived. I've done some foolish things in my life, and if I had known about alcoholism, even though I did, I didn't want to admit it at that time. During that time, I also... I sound like the male chauvinistic pig, but... during that time, I also met another girl that I had met during my first divorce, and I called her up because I was lonely. I felt abandoned, and I called her up and said, "Can you come over?" She came over, and that one night, I have a son because of it. And instead of taking care of my responsibility and taking care of the child support and doing what I was supposed to do by law, I ran. I was afraid. I ran. And I left her. Luckily, she was married and had a family for my son. So for 8 years of my life, I had nothing to do with my son. And that kills me to this day that I was that irresponsible. And it's the disease of alcoholism that was part of it. That was a tough time. I ran away and moved to Denver, Colorado, and met another girl that I met on the internet. That's real smart, too, by the way. We were together for 18 months. Yeah, 18 months. There you go, 18 months. Well, anyways, she was real jealous of me. She always thought I was cheating on her, and I wasn't. This is when I was being true to her. Actually, I wasn't. Alcohol was my mistress. I was cheating on her with the bottle. But I broke up with her right around 9/11, right before 9/11, 2001. And then that fateful day came, and she called me up and said, "I really want to be with people I love. Can I come over?" And I said, "Sure." So we were together until December. In December, I finally had enough of her jealousy, and I said, "You know, she's real needy." I guess I was too, but I didn't see it that way. But I broke up with her, and New Year's Eve, I had to go to Dallas to bury my grandfather, and I came back New Year's Eve, and she picked me up because I didn't have anybody to look after my dogs, and she took care of my dogs in my house while I was gone. And I'll never forget the last thing I said to her. I said, "This has been a real expensive year. You can keep the car." And I went out partying with my buddies. When I came home New Year's Day,
I found her. She had shot herself with one of my guns. And that wasn't even a wake-up call for me. And I kept drinking. For two more years, I stayed in Denver and just drank my life away. And I was willing to kill myself because of this alcoholism. Finally, one day, my dad called and said, Drew, he said, we want you to come home. He said, we've got a cabin out at Lake Whitney that you can move into. And you can stay there rent-free until you get a job. And that's what I did. I packed up everything I owned, and I came to Whitney, Texas. About 2 months after that, I met the wife I'm with now. And I mean, she's seen it all. She's been there with my DWIs. I mean, I got four DWIs in less than 2 years. And two of them were in Bosque County, which doesn't look good on my record at all. She saw me drinking to where I just didn't have a care in the world. She saw me going out and wanting to fight the neighbors because they drank less than I did. You know, but she saw all this, and half the time I don't remember going out wanting to fight the neighbors. I don't remember any of it, but I just wanted somebody to end my misery is what I wanted, and I figured by fighting somebody bigger than me, that would end my misery, and it didn't. It just got me black and blue and broken sternums, and it just messed me up physically. It didn't help me mentally at all. May 9th, I got a call. Actually four calls, and all my buddies and I were sitting out drinking and partying around a campfire in my front yard, and every phone call I just said, oh, the answer machine will get it, I'll pick them up in the morning, and just so I could stay partying, I didn't answer the phone. Next morning I started listening to the messages. The first call was from my half-sister, Deanne, and she said, have you heard the news yet? And I'm thinking, what news? And the next call was from my aunt and said, have you heard about Ty? I said, what about Ty? And then the third one was from my mom. She said, Drew, call me. I need to talk to you now. And right then, my gut just fell. I knew something was wrong. I said, this can't be good. And I picked up the phone and called my mother. And I said, what's the problem? She said, Ty was in an accident yesterday afternoon. I said, well, what hospital is he in? He's lived through these accidents before. She goes, no, you don't understand. He didn't make it. Your brother's dead. This was my only brother, my idol. Guy that I followed him to fire and back for, and he was gone, no longer. It was just me. I was the last of the Mohicans. That was a week before his birthday, and that Saturday we went to the viewing, and I walked in that room, and I'm still an alcoholic. I'm still practicing, okay? And it didn't stop me from practicing. But I walked in that room, and I could feel Ty in that room. I could feel him on that gurney. I could feel his spirit in there, and I could hear what he was saying to me. Drew, don't fuck up. You're the man now. And that's what I could feel. I had to walk out of that room. It was so intense. And Cindy came with me, and she came outside with me, and she hugged me. And that was the best thing I could ever have, is that hug at that moment. At that time, I was asked to do the eulogy at his funeral. My brother was a successful architect. He made real good money. He worked for a real good company. He had a wife and my nephew, Austin. And when I was asked to do the eulogy, at first I said no because I was scared. And then I thought about it and I said, you know what, that's what my brother would want. So I went ahead and did the eulogy, and I told my mom I'd do it because that's what Ty would want. And while I sat up there, there were 250 to 300 people that my brother's life touched that were there at that funeral. And I spoke in front of those people, and I wasn't scared in front of them. But when I got home, I was scared of being alone again. And I started drinking and drinking and drinking. And July 24th, Officer Blind Thing, Bosque County's finest, I love him to death, he's my friend now, but he pulled me over and I got my fourth DWI.
and they shipped me to Mosby County's finest, the jail over here. And I knew that if I got out, I would continue drinking. And I called my wife and told her, just leave me in here. I said, there's no reason to bond me out because I know I'm going to continue drinking. Funny thing happened in that jail cell, though. My mom sent me a big book, and I started reading this book. Well, it's not the hard copy because you can't have those in jail. You can cut somebody with one of those. But she sent me that big book, and I started reading it, and I started reading a little bit of it, and then they had AA meetings every Tuesday night, well, almost every Tuesday night, and I started going to those meetings in jail. And then the 20th day I was in there, my mother came and visited me with my stepdad and my wife. And they told me at that moment that my brother was drunk when he wrecked his motorcycle and killed into his life. And I didn't know that until that moment. And I don't know much about, at that time I didn't know anything about a spiritual awakening or an aha moment I just didn't know anything about that. But I went back in my jail cell and I could picture those 250 people at my brother's funeral and how he let all those people down. And I don't talk bad about my brother much, but he let all those people down. And I knew at that moment I couldn't let all the people, even if it was half as much as that, people that I'd let down if I continued drinking. I couldn't do it. And right after that, the jailer said, you got another visitor. I said, no. I said, you can't have but one visit a day on Sunday. He said, I know how the rules work. He said, no. He said, you got another visitor. Well, it's kind of funny. Speaking of just having a spiritual awakening, and there was a minister coming to visit me that I used to wait tables on. And it just clicked. That's how God wanted it to happen in my life. All of a sudden, I knew that there's more than just drinking and getting in trouble. I knew that I had a life. So I called Cindy and had her come get me out of jail that moment. And I went to an AA meeting in Whitney, Texas. And the most ironic thing about it, which wasn't ironic at all now that I see how it went, the topic was spiritual awakenings. And if that, I mean, that just hit the nail right on the head. And, well, I was out of jail for about 40 days, and I'd gone to meetings every night. I found a sponsor, and I was doing what my sponsor said, and I was following the program. I was starting to work the steps. And I went to court for that felony DWI, and, you know, they had what they call a pre-sentence investigation because the judge was out that day, the felony judge was out. And they said, go talk to your probation officer. And I went to go talk to my probation officer. And he looked at me and said, so, you want me to call the sheriff now? Or do you want to spend 30 minutes with your wife? And I said, excuse me? He said, well, you violated your misdemeanor probation on your third, on your second. He thought it was my second DWI, but it was actually my third. He said, you violated your probation on your misdemeanor DWI, and the judge put a warrant for your arrest with no bond. So I said, but I'm working the steps. I got AA. You can't do this to me. I've actually got my life back together. Yeah, 40 days. Well, next thing you know, I'm being carted off to jail. I called him a couple other names too, but I wasn't very happy at that moment, and neither was Cindy. When she saw him cart me off, she about cried, and that broke my heart. But the next 20 days until I got to the felony court, I read and I talked about AA, and I lived AA in that jail cell, and I talked to other people about AA, and that's where I met David. He started coming in during that time, and that's when we were fighting about where God was, who God was, and I don't believe in God, and this, that, and the other. Well, you know what? It doesn't matter what I think. It's, well, it does. It's the chapter to the agnostics. It says it in there, the God of your own conception, the way you, the God you believe in. And I finally, that 20 days was miraculous because I didn't feel lonely. I had God with me. I didn't feel abandoned, even though I was in jail. And Yeah, I hated that judge for a while. We know the judge we're talking about. Now he's one of my best buddies in AA. But when I finally got up in front of that felony judge, another judge, and I could actually see God working in the legal system. God even works in the legal system. Is that not wild? But I'm in front of that judge, and he says, "Son, looks like you have a problem with alcohol." I said, "Yes, Your Honor, I do." He said, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" I said, "Well, I've been going to AA. So I got a sponsor. I said, I have a letter from my sponsor. I have a letter from my wife. I have a letter from my boss. I've got letters." He said, and I didn't have it at the time, but my attorney, my court-appointed attorney had them. I got some choice words to say about it too, but I'm going to keep them to myself. But anyways, the judge looked at my attorney and said, "Have you seen these letters?" And my attorney said, "No, Your Honor." And I looked at the judge and looked at my attorney. I said, "My wife gave him those letters this morning." The judge says, "Is that true?" He goes, "Well, I haven't read them." And the judge right then scratched off the prison and put 5 years probation. And right there, I could see God working in my life. I should be in prison. I should be under the prison. And God and AA and that judge somehow worked it out to where I had 5 years felony probation. I'm still on it today. I still have to get my thing signed for going to AA meetings, which is fine with me. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm not ashamed of anything. At that point, I got out of jail, and that was just miraculous. And I got to see Uncle Cole, too, that day. And I've talked to him since then. I talked to him this year at Man to Man, and we actually had a real good understanding. And I told him that I wrote a book, and when I was proofreading the book, his name wasn't mentioned in the book. And it's kind of funny. I said, "You know what? At that point, I realized I didn't have a resentment towards you anymore." And he gave me a hug and said, "I'd like to read your book." So I sent him a copy of it. It talks about everything I'm talking about tonight. Today, the way I see and live my AA program is, as far as the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable. I knew that from the start. I knew that even before I got into AA. Look at my life. It was a roller coaster. And God wasn't in my life. You know, if He was in my life, it probably would have gone a lot smoother. And as far as the came to believe that the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, that was the tough one for me. I fought David about that. I thought a lot of other people about that. But when I finally understood that first you came to meetings, then you came to, and then you came to believe. It's a process. And now I know that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity because He's already doing it every day. As far as the made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him, I thought it was going to be a hard step, but it actually turned out pretty easy because I was turning my will over to God while I was in that jail cell. And now every day I work with God in my life and not against Him. And, you know, I pray every morning for Him. I pray every night. Sometimes I pray 5 or 6 times in the day. He's with me all the time. I'm not alone anymore. And I know that. I can be all by myself at the lake fishing and know I'm not alone. As far as made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourself, I did that twice. First time I got down, I wrote. I did the columns and who I heard and this, that, and the other, and what part I played in it. And you know what? 99% of the time, I played the biggest part in that. I was the problem there. It was my alcoholism. And my sick mind. And the second time, I had a dream, and I woke up from the dream, and I sat and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. I was 18 months sober at the time. And like David said, I ended up with a manuscript. And I don't know how that happened. I didn't do it. It was God with me that did it. And it was just, as I wrote the fourth step, I could feel release. I could feel the tension leaving me. I could all of a sudden feel free. And then when I did the fifth step, when I admitted to my sponsor the exact nature of my wrongs, that's when it was like being cleansed all the way through. And I mean it. I've never felt that feeling before, and I don't think I'll ever feel it anymore. Well, I feel it every day, actually. But I'm not ashamed anymore, because somebody knows my wrongs. Somebody knows what I did. Somebody knows how bad of a person I was because of this disease. And how bad you can get if you don't have God on your side. It happened to me. I know it. 6 and 7, I skipped over the first time I tried them, and I went right to 8 and 9, which was a mistake. I was in a meeting, and I heard some of the old timers say they skipped over it too. And I said, whoa, it was like an aha moment again. I skipped over them. I need to go back and do those. So every day I work on those. I try to have God remove those defects of character and all the shortcomings in my life. And with time, he'll help me with that. As far as 8, I have made a list, and I am willing to make amends to all people I've harmed. I know that. 9, I don't think I'll ever, I don't know, maybe one day. But the 9th step was a hard one for me. I'm working on it every day. As long as I keep going forward and don't stay in one spot, don't get stagnant, I know it's going to work through my life. And even when I wrote my 4th and 5th step, I was kind of doing the 9th step. My amends to my brother was made. My amends to Cole was made. It was weird. When I was writing, I was making amends. I didn't even know it until after I read it again. As far as 10, 11, and 12, those are important to me. I do them every day. I continue to take personal inventory. I take an inventory in the morning, noon, at night. I had a class I was going to here in Meridian until they said I graduated. But I was court ordered to go, and Miss Linda was a big part of my life during that time I was in that class. I went for about a year and a half, and the 10th step was very important in her class to relapse prevention. And the way that you do it is you do it every morning, every noon, at night. Sometimes you just take yourself away to do it. You make it an inventory of people you might have harmed during that day, and then you promptly admit it. Promptly means right then and there. Do it then. As far as 11, sought through prayer and meditation to prove our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. I try every day to pray. I do pray every day, but I don't meditate every day. I should. And I know praying is talking to God, and meditating is listening. And as far as having a conscious contact with God, I know I do. I got a little story that happened to me at work, and I could feel the conscious contact. It was one of those aha moments, those spiritual awakenings, I guess is what you call it. Or that's what they call it in the big book. But I had this guy call me up. This was about 2 months ago, so I was almost had years of sobriety. And I got a call from this guy that says, what time y'all close? And see, I run a restaurant, or kind of run it. Well, I don't run it. I'm actually just there. But he said, well, he said, what time do you close? I said, we close at 2. He said, well, that's a shame. He said, my wife and I got company, and we wanted to come at 3. And I said, well, you know what? I said, I can stay open. I'm going to be here anyways. Come on in. We'll take care of you. And I was just doing what I thought was right. And then when he came to the door, I saw it was one of my hardest customers to deal with. And I said, oh, well, you know what? I'm here. I got to do my job. Let's just treat him like royalty. And I did. And I could feel the conscious contact with God because I gave him love. And I don't think he's ever had love in that restaurant before. And I just treated him like I would treat my own family or my friends, my neighbors. I treated him with respect. And his son paid for the bill. His son was, his company's from out of town. And he left me a $20 tip, so I was really happy about that. And then when he was walking to this man was walking to the bathroom, And I was by the kitchen. He stopped me and said, Drew, he said, I've been watching you for the past couple of years. And he said, you know, he said, there's a big difference in you. He said, whatever you're doing, keep it up. And right then, my conscious contact with God just hit me square in the face. And I felt like I was floating. I was buoyant. And when they left, I walked up to the table and I started cleaning it off. And I lifted up his napkin and there was a $20 bill. And I went over to where his wife was sitting. I lifted up her napkin and there was another $20 bill. And that, I don't know if you've ever had a conscious contact with God, but that was mine at that moment in time. It worked. It worked. It really did. As far as step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. That was part of that in all of our affairs. And as far as practicing these principles, it's not that hard. It's a simple program. You just work it, like get a sponsor and work it the way they worked it, or that they were taught to work it, and the way they were taught to work it. It's handed down to you, and it's easy. It's really easy. I thought it was trigonometry when I first got into it. And you know what? It's basic math. It's easy. There were three other things, and I'll be done at that point. The big question in my life before AA was, where was God? God was with me at birth. God was with me in my accidents. I lived and there was survival. God was with me when my brother died, because I don't know if I'd have had the spiritual awakening at the time that I did if it weren't for him dying. I was told by my sponsor that you have to get positives out of negatives. And I was at man-to-man, I heard this joke, and all of a sudden it clicked. And there's that aha time again. And it wasn't a spiritual awakening, it was just a joke. But this guy was in the hospital with two broken legs, and the doctor came in and said, son, he said, I got some good news and bad news. What do you want to hear first? He said, well, he said, I want to hear the bad news first. He says, well, we're going to have to amputate both your legs. He goes, oh man, that's terrible. He said, yeah. He said, you want to hear the good news? He said, yeah, what's the good news? He said, well, the guy in the bunk next to you wants to buy your shoes. So you can always get a positive out of a negative, no matter how little it is. Out of my brother's death, I got sober. I don't, you know, it's true. It really is true. But anyways, that's how it was like, what happened, and what my life's like now. And the way my life is now, I wouldn't want to change it. And thanks to AA and friends like David, friends like Cole, and my wife for putting up with me, I thank you. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, man.
What a privilege hearing you tell your story. I can't imagine in 2 years being able to stand up or sit down and speak so eloquently. I can't do that now. I stuttered and stammered through it. I had
cheat sheets.
Yeah, but you can tell most of it's coming straight from the heart. And that's, it's just such a blessing to be able to see people come in and grab a hold of this group. And one of those that was proud of thank you for being here. That's my pleasure. All right. Chips. We give out chips over the new year chips.
Keith,
you give out the monthly chips.
Alright, we ain't got glasses, so we're gonna win yet. The Reading Group 2 chip systems recognize different lengths of sobriety. Our first chip is Desire Chip. Is there anyone here that would like to try our way of life for the next 24 hours? Is there anyone here that needs to reestablish a sobriety day to return a wet one for a dry one? Is there anyone here to celebrate 1 month of continued sobriety? 2 months? 3 months? 6 months? 9 months? 18 months? Is there anyone here that has a yearly birthday today that would like to give now? Yearly birthday celebrations are held on the last Wednesday of each month. Going once? Going twice?
Thank you. For your self-cleaning through our own efforts, please remember everything shared here was shared in strict confidence. Please do not repeat it to anyone who is not here tonight. We got a humongous cake out there, so I better see everybody with a plate full of cake.
Just one thing, that 18 months is broken. My wife and I are celebrating our 5th year anniversary, August 12th.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No more 18 months.
They are a miracle.
I know.
I don't think there's no 5th year anniversary gift.
That's a different program. Let's close with Serenity Prayer and Eat Cake.
Lord's Prayer.
What's your email address?
Just with that, start us off.
Who walks on rivers and saves our livers?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation,
but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Keep coming back to
your
work.
Hey, it's easier.
Anytime.